Oh, I think we got everybody that's going to stay here. So, audio interfaces, a couple of examples, and then we're actually going to do some real experiments here. When you're doing your own integration, you're going to come into looking at the audio interfaces. You might be confronted with all of these things you see on the screen here, and you're going to have to match whatever version your interface is with whatever version that your computer has, and you want them to match, otherwise you're going to have some troubles. And the OS drivers that come with these things, I'm going to speak mostly from the Windows world. The drivers that you get are something you have to pay attention to, and the other things that are playing on your computer at the same time. And there are things called deferred procedure calls in the software world. And these deferred procedure calls are by other drivers that are in the system or other pieces of software. If they hog the system and grab onto it and don't let go in a timely fashion, this is a source of why you have to have either large buffers or suffer stuttering, drop samples, other kinds of problems that you could cause nasty results with your audio. And let's see, do I have some tools here? Sorry. There's some tools I'm going to mention later that help you with trying to find out about these deferred procedure calls, hogs. If somebody's holding on to things, there's two or three different software pieces that can help you with that. As far as interfaces go, you know, again, you get what you pay for. When you're up at the top end here in the RMEs, these things are really nice interfaces. They've got great specs. And the RME has something in particular that's nice. It's got a built-in patch bay. They call it Total Mix. And the patch bay allows you to patch an incoming physical to an incoming logical into your software. And the same thing, outgoing logical to an outgoing physical. Or you can patch an incoming physical to an outgoing physical. And not only can you patch them around, but these patches can have gain or attenuation. So you can play all kinds of interesting things. That's why they call it Total Mix. It takes a little bit to learn, but it's well worth doing. And it's a poor man's sim when it comes to having multiple branches that you have eight microphones set up and you want to be able to punch through real quick and pick up different spots in your room when you're taking a measurement on a specific speaker.
And they spec them, their noise and dynamic range, non-A-weighted, too.
That's also true. They're one of the few that don't use the A-weighting to hide the evils of low-frequency noise.
I don't trust any of the other ones.
Right.
Well, there's a reason they call it A-message weighting. How many of us here are doing telephone-grade speech?
Some of us.
So, RME is kind of a... You can buy more expensive interfaces, but this is it's a pretty nice point that you're not too worried about things at that point above. Mark of the Unicorn I've never used before, but I've had people who use it that highly regard it, and they've mostly been Mac world, but recently they're starting to introduce products that are accommodating the Windows world as well. The M-Audio Fast Track Pro, actually that's a $250 box, and that's what JJ was working with this morning. And this afternoon I'm using a Focusrite, not the Scarlett that you see on the screen, but the Sapphire 6. You can get good work done with these devices. You just don't get the most exemplary specifications. So if you want to do those noise criteria measures I was talking about, always referred to, or very low noise work, you need to be up in this interface region. But down here, this stuff will suffice and get plenty of good work done. And Mackionics, Blackjack, $150, Tascam, US-100, $100. You can do work with those. M-Audio used to make a thing. I can't remember what it was. It was a $100 interface, had the little 8th-inch TRS connectors on it. It worked plenty fine for this kind of work.
Here's a point to some of these things. You can also, if you want to do things like make a low and sine wave and octave and just run it out and back in the capture or something like that, you can do a lot of stuff like that to measure your own equipment. I mean, you can do anything in audio precision while doing octave if you have a moderate idea of how to write.
Mm-hmm.
And you put in a plus or minus 4-bit sine wave, you know, bottom 4 bits, and loop it back, take a look at what you get on the other side.
And there's also a piece of software in the Windows world called RMAA that kind of does that. And some of you may be familiar with it. It's a, it was freeware. I think the deal is he's now charging for some of the extra features. But it does just that. You loop back both channels. You get them close to one another. And it goes through and tells you your frequency response, your harmonic distortions, crosstalk, all those kinds of things. Gives you kind of a goodness. And you measure various of these things, and you actually do see differences between them. But you can, again, you got to be careful how you set up the measurement. You can cause the device, let's say the outgoing signal, you gain stage it a little bit improperly, and the inbound ones, so that you don't have quite the dynamic range, say, on your outbound. The weakest link in the chain will be the thing that gets measured. And you can set this up, and I can demonstrate this if anybody's interested. You can set up so I can take the same box here and show you 95 dB signal noise, or I can show you 76 dB signal noise, same box, just by the way I adjust it, which is why the gain staging is so important, we talked about at the beginning. And just a couple of pictures so you can visualize. We talk about these boxes with numbers, but here's what an RME Fireface UC looks like. There's the M-Audio FastTrack Pro. And examples of a system implementation, I've already talked about this earlier. One of the simplest things you could do is the Omni mic that Bill Waslow makes, USB mic. Mic plugs into the USB, you load the software on, you take the WAV files they provide you, puts an iPod, run it into an amplifier, run this thing up to about 85 dB SPL at a meter. Put your mic in place, get it close to the speaker if you want to do speaker measurements, move it farther back, get room measurements, you're up and flying, literally in about 5 minutes. It's that simple. A little more complicated, like what we're doing here today, except I don't have the buyer up, I have the Nady up. But the Nady's a $50 microphone, a Focusrite $150 interface, USB cable, our loop back out to the amp speaker. That's pretty much what we've got going right here that we'll be doing experiments on. So there's an inexpensive example. These are the pieces of software I was talking about when you're getting stuck with my audio stutters. I'm losing samples. Things aren't working right. This DPC latency checker, and there's a link in the very last slide, gives you the link to find this piece of software. Helps you find out what the deferred procedure calls are doing, how much time they're spending hogging the system, and they have arbitrarily set 2 milliseconds as being a threshold where they color the bars red. If it's longer than 2 milliseconds, they say it's bad. But it's really up to you. You have to decide your buffer lengths, what's tolerable to you in the way of latency. When we're doing measurements like this, latency isn't such a big deal. When you're doing a digital audio workstation and you're actually running sound through the system and then back out again for a cue mix or something, latency becomes a real important thing. And 2 to 3 milliseconds starts to become an appreciable latency. Your vocalists aren't going to like that much delay in their own voice coming back out to the cans. So these are helpful pieces of software. The Microsoft RATTV3 is a little harder to understand, but it also picks up a lot more software that might hog the system, including anything that uses the interrupt service routines and the timer DPCs, which I'm not sure I fully appreciate what those are. But I know it tracks them and can help you track down who in your system is hogging what. And then Sentrance makes an ASIO latency checker. I've never actually played with this, but other people have. And it seems to be similar to this DPC latency checker. So with that, I'm kind of through boring you with all the overview of the systems. We're actually going to take a look at a few real-world measurements, and then we're going to do them. We're going to look at a speaker frequency response, a measurement system comparison, microphone comparison, and then an acoustic door performance. Now, these first three are actually walking you through, do I trust that I'm getting results with this inexpensive system as if I had a more expensive system? And the answer is, within the realm of what you're trying to do here, yes, it works. I'm picking a Genelec 8030A. This is their published specifications. This is one of the reasons I like this particular speaker. It's well documented. They give you decent information. You notice they use Audio Precision to do their measurements. And from about 60 hertz on up to 20 kilohertz, it's plus or minus a couple of dB when you're on axis at about a meter out. And then they even start to show you your off-axis performance. And that's, I believe, is a power, a lower curve is the system power response. So, question. Here's a frequency response for this speaker. Can we get that in a real-world situation that's non-anechoic? And the answer is you get pretty close. Here is, in a real world, notice we've got plus and minus 12 dB per division here. But take a look at this frequency response, starting at about, let's say 500 hertz. And this is, mind you, this is 6 octaves smooth, whereas this was not 6 octaves smooth. This is a much more raw bit of data. And those two track pretty well. Now, I bet you could tell something about the dimensions of the room I'm in by these. I'll bet those would cue you into the size of the room. Okay, this is using the 8030 in a real room. I've got that ACO 7046 mic, the one I have been using for a reference all along in here. And let's switch systems. This is done on Smart Live. Let's go to Room EQ Wizard. So I've switched from a $900 piece of software to a freeware. Does this curve look much different than that one? You can find the peaks and the valleys in pretty much the same place. The one difference is you are limited to either the raw or third octave smoothing. You don't get any other choice, but it's free. Those two pretty much match. And we're still using our ACO 7046 mic. Okay, now let's say we switch down to this microphone, the $200 microphone. Well, it looks like we got pretty much the same answer again. So let's overlay those two. Okay, I've gone from a $3,000 system down to the cost of this mic, basically, and the audio interface, and I'm getting pretty much the same results. So change it out to octave. I'm sure you would have gotten the same results if you did the third octave smoothing, same way, to make it look like this. So you can do real-world measurements with inexpensive stuff. You just have to know how to use it, make sure you don't mess up your signal path, and know the calibrations. If you really want to know that this is 90 dB right in there, if you really want that to be 90 dB and know it is, you need to know your calibrations. Okay, second example. I'm having an acoustic laboratory built on the Redmond campus of where I work. For the last 10 years, I've been under house arrest working in my own space because the company I work for didn't see the value in having an acoustic laboratory. So I built one, and built a pretty sophisticated one. It doesn't look like much, but it does work very well when you know the space and know how to exploit it. Well, they finally realized the value in having their own space, and so they decided to build me a space. But it's in a manufacturing facility, so I'm going to have some problems with it. The first one being that I don't have a separate concrete slab from the rest of the manufacturing facility, so when somebody drops the forks on the first floor, I'm going to hear them in the second floor. There's just no getting around it. But at least the thing ought to perform as well as the components used to build it. It was built with STC 50 walls and an STC 46 door. Those are transmission loss values for those who don't recognize what I'm talking about, but Lindsay and Mark will know. And when they first put it up, they said, "There you go, Mr. Smith, you're done." And they never expected I would actually measure it and see that it would, how well it performed, and it didn't perform. This is the frequency response of the thing we put into the protected space, and then we went to the intermediate chamber. The protected space is the inner room. Then there's a control room. There's this expensive door we're talking about, expensive for our company. I actually look at it as being a McDonald's Happy Meal of acoustic doors, but that's another story. Anyway, it opens between the control space and the inner space, and then there's another sort of acoustic door, even a cheaper version done, that from the control room out to the electrical engineering labs and into the rest of the, and then that room goes out in the rest of the space. The outer room in the electrical engineer's lab doesn't have anything special done for the HVAC. The inner sanctum and the control room both have special things done for the HVAC, and they did do a nice job on that. But they didn't do a nice job on this door, and when we did the computation here, instead of getting an STC, in the lab you'll get your rating for the door, but in the real world you don't usually get that exactly. You're down by a couple of dB for real world implementations. But you shouldn't be down 10 dB, and we were down, I think it was, we were getting what we thought to be an STC 35 to 37 performance out of an STC 46 door. And as you went along the door seal, the gasket, you saw that the gasket was waving. It had undulations in it. So when the door would close, it would close on some of the gasket, but there were gaps in others. And you could actually run your ear up and down when we were playing the pink noise in the room. And you could hear the leaks coming in the high frequencies. So here we're using a single linen system. We're doing a real-time analysis. And we've got our source signal inside the room here, and this is what we're measuring at the door, outside the door. And notice this area right here and this area here. These are the frequencies where we're getting the leak, 500 to 1,000 hertz, and again, 4 kilohertz to 8 kilohertz. The low frequency you got to ignore, because this room is not very well isolated low frequencies. Sorry, that room's just not going to ever achieve that. But it should be something looking like this one at a lower level out here. And this clued us in that we weren't really getting that. So we complained. They were astonished. We made them come back and reinstall a gasket. The fellow who came back this time downloaded the instructions from the door vendor's website. An amazing thing. He followed the directions. An amazing thing. It performed much better, as evidenced in this gold. You can see we improved in the 500 to all the way up to 16 kilohertz. Everything improved, and now we got an STC 43 performance out of our STC 46 door, more like it should be. Second fellow did a novel thing. He followed the directions. So that is the end of my real-world examples that are canned. Here's where we're going to go into the live demonstrations. But before we get to those live demonstrations, I think Dan has a few things to say about the sim. And then he's going to run the sim first, and then, are we going to run the sim and the smart together?
Yeah.
Okay.
But let me do my presentation.
Okay. And then, do you want me to take back the main, or do you want to stay on the main and have me go to the auxiliary?
I don't care about that. All right, so we're going to take a very quick look at this. We could look at this for a week and not get to the end of it. It's first implemented around 1985 by Meyer Sound Laboratories, which was a speaker manufacturer, and it still is. There's a fundamental Meyer principle to this. And I should say that I'm not a Meyer employee and I'm not a Meyer insider. This is what I've gleaned from observation over the years, and I'm sure I'll have some of it wrong, but you'll get the idea here. They have a fundamental principle. Each speaker box of a particular model should sound exactly the same as any other speaker box of that same model to the limits of manufacturing capability. And their challenge is to refine that by messing around with different parts of it and improving stuff over time so that every box is exactly the same as every other box. And the reason for that, or one way to accomplish that, is to remove user-adjustable parameters as much as possible. So there's no adjustable crossovers, there's built-in power amplifiers eventually. They first started off with a dedicated box that had the crossover in it, but you still had to use regular power amplifiers, and by adjusting the left versus right amplifier channels, you could change the crossover frequency and adjust the frequency response, which meant that one box wasn't necessarily the same as another. So they got rid of those external power amplifier options and put built-in amps in it. So with these speakers that are now commonplace, a powered speaker, you have a line level input, an AC power input, and that that's it. That's the user adjustable parameters. It's reliable and repeatable. So how that applies to SIM is that you have a single purpose proprietary computer. There's no connection to the internet or any other computers, so you're not going to get any viruses. Your data inside the system is not subject to contamination by other programs. You're not worried about if your word processing program is interfering with your audio processing program, etc. It means that my SIM machine, and they call it the SIM machine, it's exactly the same as your SIM machine, which is exactly the machine, the same as that one. So when you get into discussing fine points of measurement differences, you're not worried about, well, I'm using this computer with this processor, and you're using that computer with that processor, and so you get the idea there. So that's why they do that. And I think this is close to the last point here. The designers of SIM were often equalizing and optimizing sound systems, having several, if not dozens, of zone subsystems, front fill, side fill, rear fill, etc. They needed a way to efficiently control the testing of these subsystems, which involves muting of all but the subsystem under test, and then comparing that subsystem under test integration with one or more of the other subsystems. So you need to be able to turn things on and off quickly, be able to go through a system. And quickly means a relative, is a relative term. And I should confess now that I don't really use SIM in my day-to-day sound operation work because I have maybe a half an hour sometimes. Usually I have about 5 minutes to do the EQ of the PA. And if I have a full day or something, then I'll use the SIM. But I don't really have that many opportunities to do that anymore. I need to get in fast and get out fast. So that's enough of that, I guess. So this is the slide Bob showed you earlier, and I'm going to show you that Meyer's terms for these different points in the system are the console, that you take the input, the output signal of a console and run it into a line to one of the inputs on it. Then you have the processor, which is either an equalizer or a delay or whatever, but it's processing the signal somehow, and they call that processor. And there's an input point on the output of that, so that you can compare, as Bob said, what the processor has done to the signal. And you can see it on your screen to see that. And then there's another point over here, which is your measurement microphone, to see what the combination of speaker and room has done to the signal. So by looking at those three positions, console, processor, and mic, you've got the basis of what's going on at SIM, and we'll see some more later. So looking at the front panel of it, you can see there's not a lot of connections to it. There's a generator section here with an output to the generator, so you can get into your console, mixing console. There's two line level inputs and two mic level inputs. There's a headphone that's actually an output. Headphone control with some solo buttons over here, so you can listen to any of these individually through your headphones so that you can know for sure what it is you're measuring. There's a keyboard port, a mouse port, a CD drive here, which is the only input and output device. You can put CDs in there that have a program or data in it and get it into your SIM, or you can burn a CD to give to somebody else. And that's the extent of the controls. There's a power switch as well. Looking at the back panel, the power connection goes there. There's a video output, so you can connect it up to screens. Keyboard, parallel keyboard ports and mouse ports. You can only use one at a time, though, one set at a time. There's an Ethernet port on the back that's reserved for future use. It's not connected to anything, so there's no connection to the world. Another generator output. And then there are some connectors to connect to optional devices, a line switcher and a mic switcher. The line switcher is if you need more than two line inputs. This is essentially just a status indicator on the front panel. The back panel is where it gets interesting. And up here we see the front panel again, and then here's the back panel. And then these are all cables that connect to the back panel so that you have sends from the console, channel 1 through 8, and I seem to have cut off the 1 through 8 down here, return to the processors, and then a send from the processors and a return to the loudspeakers. So what this does is it physically interrupts the signal from the console to the EQs or processors. And then you take the signal, the output of the processors, or EQs, go back into this and come out and send that to the speakers. And what that allows you to do is to turn any of those on or off using the SIM system so that you can isolate, like I said, one section from another, one subsystem from another subsystem. Then if you need more, if you want to set out more than one microphone, if we were going to take this microphone and measure close up, near midfield, far field, off to the side, measure the speaker that's in the back room, measure the speaker that's out in the other room, we've got to physically move this microphone around. This line mic switcher allows you to set out up to 8 microphones, up to 10 really, in addition to the two on the front panel, so that you can go zip, 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 zip amongst them and quickly measure one subsystem compared to the other. What I've learned is that even that is a big pain in the neck. And it takes a long time physically running these microphones out and putting them in places. So that's the end of that. Now I'm going to change the input. Do you want to start talking about what we're going to do?
Sure.
Okay.
There we go. We're going to run these two systems in parallel. We're going to put pink noise out our point source here, although you notice it's not really a point source, it's two drivers. And the common microphone, we split it between us. And if things work well, we should get the same answer. One thing I'm going to point out is in both systems, we'll be finding the delays. There'll be an impulse response screen where you find the delay from the speaker to the mic. And both of them will give you a frequency response. But what's this curve up here, this one up the top? This is called a coherence curve. It's a correlation between the reference channel that's coming, being looped back, and our system under test. And what this coherence channel does is basically it's telling you something about the quality of your measurement. If everything is correlating really well, meaning that what you're comparing from the reference, the system under test to the reference, is highly correlated, you'll get a very high number up here. And that's this scale over here. This red line on this system is the red scale. I'm not sure. Where is it on yours?
I have multiple screens here, and the coherence is over here, but I don't have any.
You don't have anything frozen yet.
Anything in there yet?
Okay, and
let's do the delay first if we can, and then we'll go to there.
Well, I'd like to finish what the things are, and then let's just run through them because once we get the pink noise, nobody's going to hear anything.
Yeah, but I'm not sequential like that, so I can't. I don't have a stored.
Okay, let me finish up the coherence. Okay. The coherence is if somebody like JJ there starts giving us a really loud whistle and the coherence goes down, not yet, it's not live, we'll see a coherence drop in a certain area, and that tells us that that particular area of our measurement is suspect. Like right here. Here was a... What is that? That's 60 hertz. Sure, probably our HVAC was really interfering. So anything, in fact, they dropped the data out. Okay, I'm going to pop the pink noise on. We're going to do the delays first.
Okay. Okay, so you'll notice that Bob's delay appears where?
Isn't it over? Right there, 2.31.
Right up there, okay. And mine is on a separate screen, and I'm at 2.30.
Let's see.
You moved the mic a little bit, I guess.
Well, but we just measured it.
But did you move it since I made this stuff? Because I was getting a little bit more than that.
Yeah, it's been
a couple
times.
Oh, you moved it, okay.
So we're 1/100th off. So I think that's within my measurement of...
0.01. One different than a digit. I'm not worried about it.
Yeah, 0.01 milliseconds. So that's, a million? 10,000th or something? Small. It's okay. So then... His shows the frequency response on the same screen. Mine, I've got to go to a different screen. But because I don't have any measurement now, I got no data.
So time to take a measurement again?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go.
Okay, so on mine I've got no smoothing. Are you smoothing?
I'm doing sixth octave smoothing.
Okay.
Let me take that off. There.
Okay, I just want to put it on.
No. Oh. What did you head for?
Are you on none now?
I've got none.
Okay, I'm on none too. And then what's your division? So that's 0 to 3 dB. So I'm 6 dB, so let me draw mine out. So 3 dB, so my zero is at about 30, and I'm going to raise that up. So I can offset the data, I can slide all the data up to what's an appropriate spot. I'm sure you can do that too, just so you get it so that it's visible. And I can change the scale over here, so that it's 3 dB per division. Actually, that's 2 divisions, isn't it? That's 1 dB per division? Yeah. Okay, there's 3 dB from there to there.
Now, why don't we clean them up a little bit? Sixth octave?
Yeah. But the scale, the physical scale, is different too.
Do you need me to change something?
I don't know what to change.
Let's see.
Here's 16K out here.
Well, one problem is his is square and yours is rectangular, so it looks different.
It's the aspect ratio. Yep.
So you can interpolate that in your head. Okay. So
same thing is take a look at this peak right here. You got
this one?
That one.
The highest one.
Yep.
It correlates fairly well at the lower frequencies. High frequencies, it's different.
That's 234. 236.
Yeah. We're running different FFT links, as JJ pointed out earlier.
Okay.
So you try and match the FFT length, is that what you need to adjust?
The question is, can we change the FFT length? And on mine, I can't. Mine seems to be fixed, and I'm guessing it's because you. Why would you want it any other length other than the best? Because if I take a measurement and I come up with some answer, and you take some measurement and come up with another answer, did I get my FFT length different than yours, and that's changed our data? So I'm guessing they went with one possibility. If there's multiple walks, there was a screen or a right click or something you did where you got multiple FFT
right
lengths.
And that is in
that one. There you go, FFT size.
Right here.
He's in 8K, and he's got a choice from 2K to 32K. Well,
what size are you using?
Whatever it is.
Meyer doesn't really divulge that information, really.
They don't exactly
say that. They do it in a non-standard way also.
Yes.
They break it up into bands.
Can you hear that?
They do it in a proprietary way, a non-standard way.
Okay.
Are they doing a filter bank instead of
FFT? They're banking it so to keep the bins relatively useful in size, not an absolute verse width across the
yeah.
Right.
So.
Yeah, the upper bands are 48 points per octave. I don't know what the lower bands are. That much I could find. Okay.
Can you change the windowing and smart between hand and having and all of that?
Can you change the windowing and smart between hand and having and all of that?
Let's see, can we?
They're using a filter
anybody
bank
know where to look?
If they're using a filter bank instead of an FFT, you might not have a meaningful option.
That's in the Meyer product. Now we're not talking to Sim.
Smart.
Earlier okay. Versions of smart.
Here we go. There.
There you go.
Yeah.
And set for
if you want to get the best bar, the best bar frequency exhaustion would be Blackman Harris, and none would be the best near frequency resolution. But I don't expect to see any difference on the deal.
You need to click apply. Don't you?
I need to redo it here real quick. Okay.
So which windowing is
that's
this?
That's a Blackman Harris. We're doing an 8K FFT.
What's the difference? Anybody see the difference?
We can look back and forth.
Oh, you know what? Let's do that. Hang on. Take that out of there.
Well, he's doing that.
There and what was the other variable you wanted to be? We're doing hand before. Let's just change one thing.
While he's doing that, I'm going to point out that we have to stop at 4, so we've got a little over an hour to do whatever we're going to do in this part. Those are spectrograph settings and not.
It's for the sliding window on the spectrograph.
Oh, did I catch the wrong one?
Yeah.
Okay. I see what's happening here on my screen that you don't get to see is I'm using a netbook and it's running a window up and down, so I only get to see part of the screen at a time down here. And I can't quite see up there without my glasses. So, where are we going?
Got your mirror glasses.
Yes. So, let's see. Let's change that. And let's go back to the transfer function. Where were we? Here's the spectrum. This is the impulse response. Spectrograph. Oh, yes, okay. Here we go. FFT size 36. Huh.
So why would you?
Maybe they don't give me a window.
What is the spectrograph setting?
That's for the waterfall, real-time waterfall plot or spectrogram.
A different thing than what we're
yes,
looking
it's,
at.
Yeah,
it's
the spec-
a sliding, small sliding window.
Right.
Spectrogram in this case is going to be time going on this axis and frequency in this axis, and it's going to move from right to left, and the intensity of the color will tell you the amount of SPL at a given frequency.
Which doesn't relate to what we're looking at now.
Right, I just realized that the it doesn't look like they give us the window for
is there
the transfer function. Yeah. They give us an FFT size,
right?
But it looks like
nothing under spectrum. The next one.
Well, that's where that's we get the general settings.
Right. Okay. Oh no, there's a data window right there. The tippy top, and right under general settings. Right below your no. Go back to the other one.
General
spectrum. Now there, general settings, data window, narrowband, and right there.
Right, but the question is that general for all of the functions in SMART, or is that just for the spectrum?
Well, it says data window. Aren't we looking at a spectrum data window underneath this?
No.
That's not a spectrum window?
We're looking at the transfer window.
Okay. See, we're looking at this function here.
Okay, never mind. See, that's what I have.
And I'd have to dig to find out if this has any influence on that. If this general setting, what I'm finding here a little bit is I'm used to SMART 5, and they've changed the user interface around a bit in SMART 7. And I'm still getting the hang of where they put everything. And they've actually taken some things away from me in things I used to be able to do in SMART 5. So apologize, I don't have quite everything down here yet. So I'm not sure that I can actually do anything here to change the window. So I'm not going to get much of a difference. The only thing I can change is the FFT size and see if that makes a difference. Is that useful?
No.
Okay.
Nancy says no, so I see no. Okay. Was there another test you wanted to do here?
Yeah. Remember when we held a piece of plywood up, we could show the comb filtering?
Right.
And we do that live. Let the units actually show you the change as we make a change in the acoustical space. So that's what we're going to do. We're both turn these on, and we'll have our wonderful JJ there running into the space. Okay, you can see the interference here. This extra, let me capture that.
You can't see anything until I put it. I don't know if it works.
Sorry.
Okay, you can also see the coherence dropping on this screen, saying we're not too sure about this measurement, but we certainly have a contaminated measurement. Do that again. Watch.
See
our contamination change? There was another contamination change. Okay. Gotcha. All right, now, can we do it this way? Home filtering. No. Turn it this way. Yes. And
pull it there. Yeah.
There we go. Okay, now we have three different signals here. There.
No, we did. I only stored one.
I'm sorry. Do you want to repeat that?
No.
Okay.
Yours is Let's look at the side one. All right.
Why don't we just take the real time out of there for the moment.
Yeah.
Here's how we started our path. We did our prefix response, such as it is. And when we put the plywood behind, notice how that contaminated our path. And if we were watching up here in the... it won't show up now, but there was another impulse showing up behind the primary one, demonstrating we're having a problem. And you notice we get a different result here. And this is actually a germane test because some of my colleagues who didn't understand what they were doing were given the task to do an IEC SPL measurement on certain tones on a device, and they'd gone into a room, a conference room, carefully put the stuff on the floor, carefully measured out 1 meter, up against the wall, the device at one end, microphone at the other end. They didn't take into account either of these two contaminations. They have the device up against the wall in one, so they're getting a contamination like this. So depending upon what frequency your tone's at, you might over or understate the actual frequency response. And then because they had the wall between them, you have this kind of a contamination. So again, we were just causing all kinds of grief. Now, they had both of these problems, and so really, in the space that they were working with, the methods they were using, they clearly didn't know what they were doing. They got worthless information, and they repeated it for hundreds of units.
We should have left the setup in another hallway, too, because I think that would have been entertaining on these machines.
Oh, we struck that. I'm sorry. But clearly, you got to be cognizant of other things in the room, and it doesn't take much to realize a podium. You got a speaker someplace, you got a podium someplace else, and you're trying to make a measurement. You got to account for the podium or a surface like this. You know, we're not doing the best of worlds here. If we're trying to do this kind of a measurement where we really want to know what the speaker's doing, we'd like to be at 1 meter. We'd like to be in an anechoic space. Some of us aren't privileged with that, so the way we get around it is that we try to maintain a 2 meter sphere of clearance around the whole space and do a different kind of window. This is where we take on our impulse response and say, I'm going to start with my impulse response, but someplace down here, so many milliseconds down, I'm going to quit. I'm going to quit using data, and that will help remove the contamination of the other surfaces in the room. But nothing comes for free. If I take and suddenly say I'm going to window myself down to 10 milliseconds of data, it also says I can't say anything about my data below 100 hertz. And if I do a 4 millisecond window, then 250 hertz becomes my bottom end. The shorter...
Not only is that becoming your bottom, you can't see the detail. You automatically smooth things. You can't see the details.
Exactly. So while these tricks work, you got to always be aware of what you're giving up. There's a lot of compromises when you're not working in an anechoic chamber. But you can do real and useful work outside that environment as long as you understand your contaminating surfaces and their impact on your measurement.
So that's one of the reasons why you put this up so high, is so that
floor bounce
is late
right
out of your impulse response.
And if I'd had my druthers, we wouldn't be near that pole, but that was a visual right sight line issue, so there it is.
Okay.
Questions? Comments? Experiment you'd like to see? You want to see us beat each other over the head with a piece of plywood?
Careful. It wasn't.
Just see if anybody's awake.
In the left corner we have.
One thing I wanted to show you is how easy it is to turn on and off speakers. This section over here.
And I would like to point out that if I had my option, if I had the money, I wouldn't mind a SIM system just for this feature, being able to have multiple things in a system and being able to very quickly turn on and off multiple speakers in a room and multiple microphones in a room.
So the green lights here indicate that these are on, and this is what they are, and I could relabel those if I wanted to. So now they're off. Now I've turned that one on. Turn that one off, and I've jumped over to this one, and it's on. I can't see.
Oh, I can see up there. Okay. Yeah.
I can see up there nicely.
And you set those up by going to what they call branches. And you can determine what's on any of these branches by doing stuff. And there's that fan tail that you saw in the back to interrupt the signal. Yeah.
Would that be something you can do with an interface like RME?
The RME will allow you to do something like this, but more limited. You'll as many channels as you have in your RME, and you won't be able to relabel them in a nice user-friendly thing, so when you're tired, it's been 12 hours into an experiment or into a shift that you're working on, you can look up and see a nice user-friendly, oh yes, that's the, what would you call it, the third element in the right stack.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And so you don't get that user-friendly feature, but yeah, if you're clever and you can remember all these things, you can sort of do it, but not quite this extensively.
So RME will allow you to label the channels. It's a little bit confusing. It's confusing. Yeah. It's very confusing. You can't do it, but it's confusing.
Right.
After the third show, can you kind of remember, is that the center, or is that the right stack, or is that the hallway, or is that the balcony? Yeah. We'll be starting to follow her sideways.
If the PAs are the same from time to time, yeah.
A fixed installation and my
And then Meyer has another variation on this called the Galileo, which is a 6-in, 16-out processor. That's sort of a matrix deal, so any of the 16 can go to any of the 16 outs can go to any of the 6-ins. And you can connect that up using one cable to this, and then you can mute everything and control everything. And we should talk about the looking at the processor or the EQ and the inversion of the trace so that you can line them up. And we're not set up to do that here, but one of the beauties of this system, thinking back to how you can look at the processor and compare it to the console, the processor bridge, and compare it to the processor to speaker to microphone bridge is on any of these. I don't have a mouse.
No, but let's say you were trying to correct this curve and that this wasn't a room problem, it was a speaker problem, and you could take this particular line here, and in the sim, you just draw your other line down, you get your Q or bandwidth and your depth, and you just match the two. And when you did that, it would essentially be taking the processor and doing the right thing, providing it's not something in the room that you're trying to correct for. Now, version 5 allowed you to do this. Version 5 of Smart had that function. It worked with certain, like the BSS speaker management system and a DVX. It would work with those. They took that feature out in 7, and I'm not sure if they intend to put it back. But it was a cool feature to be able to just go in there and match up.
Yeah, and actually you don't match up the holes, you match up the peaks. Usually in PA we're not boosting holes, we're cutting peaks. So the processor trace is going to be a hump that will match that, even though it's a cut. You do the inverse of it. And so having it be that way, it's very easy, or relatively easy, to line up those guys precisely so that your cut exactly matches the boost here, and that's a useful feature.
I forget how, but I believe the sim is able to help the operator tell which frequency irregularities are correctable and which are due to the physical acoustics.
Same right? With this smart. That's what this coherence is. This guy here is telling you, this is the coherence trace, and as it gets closer to the top here, that means 100% coherence, and as you get closer to the bottom, it means 0% coherence, or somewhere in between. And when you're up to the top here, or somewhere up there, that's a good, that's a problem that you can fix electrically. As you get down here, it's not so sure of the data, and you're not really sure what's going on there. And, am I correct on that?
Well, the real problem is that when you have a big dip in the room, that generally means you have a big peak somewhere else in the room. And, you know, you don't want to fill the holes because The irony of having a big dip due to a room, not due to the speaker, is it means that you're only storing energy at that frequency. And you have your mic is sitting in a pressure zero, but that means it's sitting in a volume velocity P. And that means that somewhere else in the room there has to be the opposite. So, you know, you generally don't, you know, if you're testing out from where your audience is, you generally don't want to fill those holes because you're going to be doing something really interesting somewhere else in the room. And if you have no coherence, it means that they can't make a measurement. It means that there's more noise in the room than your PA's putting out, basically.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any automatic features in this or any other minor program. It's all not trial and error, but it's giving you the data, and it's doing its best to give you the accurate data, but it's not telling you what you ought to do.
But room problems are things you really don't want to try and fight. You're, that's a losing battle. Lindsay, you had a question?
No, I was just saying that the coherence doesn't have anything to do with the room problems, because the room problems that are completely coherent. So that's not
fun. Well, the only time it might have something to do with the room problems is a big noise source in the room. But that's still, you know, it means still it's only, it will show up as being coherent because it can't measure because of the noise source.
Yeah, it's saying it's not clear about that measurement. It's not sure it's giving you an accurate measurement. Right?
Yes.
If you have cancellation that's due to physical issues, like that piece of plywood, you cannot fix that with EQ because you can turn up the power at that frequency, it's still going to cancel at that frequency. What you will do is introduce distortion in your system because the power amplifier is going to run out of power.
Say that again, Mark, that's real important.
If you have a cancellation due to, say, reflection off a nearby object, you cannot fix that with EQ, because if you turn up the power at that frequency, it's still going to cancel. It actually will not improve it to add power at that frequency. What you will do is unnecessarily pass the power amplifier, and I've gone into quite a few systems over the years where the amplifier was actually clipping at that frequency. Because they had put in 40 dB of boost to try to fix a hole. I'm not joking. So you can't fix it with EQ, and even if you could, it's the wrong approach. In fact, I might comment that a very, very common problem with exactly this issue is microphones either on a conference room table that are on a short stand. That should be illegal. And microphones that are on a lectern or podium where the guy is standing a couple feet from the microphone and the microphone's at the back of the podium because they don't want it in front of his face. That should also be illegal. Neither of those work. They're both guaranteed to have a phase cancellation right in the middle of the mid-band. The solution, there are only two solutions to that. Either use a boundary microphone so that there is no physical difference in the path, or stick the microphone in the guy's face where it belongs. I'm sorry, that's physics.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have suggested using an absorbing surface on either the tabletop or the lectern, and I've actually tried that. But realized it doesn't work in practice because the preacher always lays the Bible over the top of your absorbing surface, so you're back to a reflective surface when he's through with that. So either the microphone has to be at 4 or 5 inches, or you have to use a boundary mic on a lectern or a podium.
Inverse square law is your friend. Big and mine.
That kind of touches on a project that I've started kind of in response to doing this event here, is I took all of my SM58s and labeled each one and put each one of them in front of this little speaker. It's a little Meyer MM4. It's a 4-inch diameter self-powered box. It's pretty flat, in theory, from 150 up. And I put it as close as I could get it to the, put the 58 as close as I could get it to the speaker, because that's how I want people to use 58s. That's how they use them. They do them like I'm using them right now. And I figured, well, that will give me the, I want to compare one 58 to another to see if I've got any funky ones that are old. And I want it to be close because that's how it's going to be used.
Did you wash the beer out first?
Yeah, I don't get that too much. So I'm going to show you some stored traces. This is number, this is the B, letter B, and I'm just starting randomly here. Let's get it down to where we can see it all. I'm going to increase the other way. So there's the trace of it. Let's go to letter, I'm going to go to AA because I know that that's a good one. Now let's get it down to, where is it? See how it matches up. So I mean that's a pretty tight correlation between the two of them. And I figured, well, you know, there's a suck out there at about 7.5K, and this is a vocal mic, and I don't want like that, so maybe it's got that in there. So that's pretty cool. And I'll just show you a couple more to see this. Let's see. Which one was a funky one? I think that one was a funky one. So I'll get them to line up better. And you see that there's some difference there. That's not quite the same. So I figured that was a bad one. So, but then I thought, well, geez, what if I take my, I use the Audix TR40 or whatever it is in my mic, and what if I did put that there? So I'll do that, and I'm going to put this at zero, and where is it? I'm not quite sure why these aren't all lining up like they did when I was checking it. But it's got that same suck out there. And it's an omni, so that it's not, it doesn't have the proximity effect. But it's got that same issue. I'm going to turn it off so you can see which one it is. But it's even a little spikier up on top here. And I'm not sure. I've got to figure it's my measurement technique or something.
My head is bigger.
But then I'm going to go, I moved it back 6 inches. And then I've got to take that down again. And you can see where that's going. And that's relatively flatter, and then I put it off a foot, and my space is exactly acoustically treated as this space is. So there's floor reflections and stuff there, but I mean that's pretty flat. So what's happening when it's close up like that? Am I getting, is 8K coming from the entire driver as opposed to just the center? Do I need to put a hole, put a solid, a baffle with a hole in it to more simulate the size of my face? Yeah, Mark,
I'm hoping JJ can respond to this also. But here's my opinion based on similar experiences done a long time ago with vastly inferior equipment. The difference is that the low frequencies are as you described. That's proximity effect in the microphone. Notice that the Omni still had some proximity effect because there's no such thing as an omnidirectional microphone. some are more omni than others, but even the best 8-inch microphones still have some directionality. I think the difference at the higher frequencies is the loudspeaker, but not inferior performance. It's that you're with very much within the near field of the speaker, and it does not behave properly at that distance. Where's JJ?
He's busy.
Okay. Well, anyway, that's what I discovered. And some years ago, I described my experiment to Don Davis, and he agreed, although he didn't see any of the graphs or the numbers. So there was a paper maybe 15 years ago at ABS that postulated that the near field on a loudspeaker is actually, the beginnings of the near field is actually further away than most people supposed. And if I recall correctly, for a typical 4-inch single cone loudspeaker like the little Meyer, it was something in the order of a foot. So anytime you're closer than that, it's not behaving properly.
So the near field doesn't start until some distance from the speaker.
Not the far field.
At least four times the size of the radiation.
I don't know if we heard what
I said. No, it's a bare minimum of four times the size of the radiation area, the longest dimension of the radiation area. So that's a minimum. That's if it's absolutely mathematically perfect driver.
So for a typical 4-inch phone, that's about a foot.
That's
so
a foot,
16
that's
inches.
That's a foot and a half, roughly. Right. Yeah, 16 inches.
Huh. What's the dimension of the longest dimension of the box?
Well, if you want
to
start seeing,
yes,
because you get punching off the box corners. I didn't bring them, but I did some measurements of those pretty big speakers I built. You can see that. You can measure the width of the box and the height of the box by looking at the impulse response. You notice how these have rounded edges?
Yeah.
The goal of this is to not have too sharp of the refraction result, but you still will see it a little bit.
So how would you simulate a voice? If I want to simulate somebody being this close to a microphone, how do I simulate that?
Part of the problem is when you're this close to a microphone, you're actually you're not in the far field of your voice either, because the voice is not omnidirectional at all. So,
but this is how the microphone is used. So
that's a good question. Actually, you probably have the right way to do it would be to actually build something with a radiation pattern like a mouth.
That's the BNK torso.
Yeah.
The BNK torso.
Yeah.
But is that a speaker in the mouth?
Speaker in the mouth. The reference point is 1 inch straight out the front. And the radiation pattern is fairly close to a real person.
Yeah. Huh. I mean,
and it only costs $5,000.
Yeah. Let's see. Divided by 24 microphones.
Doesn't MT Instruments also make the talk box?
Yeah. What's that?
MT Instruments, the talk box?
Yeah. It's still up here.
Yeah,
but if you're looking for microphones, if you're looking just for microphones, just doing the exact same setup with all of them, I can tell you if they're consistent at least.
Right, and that's what I
did. Yeah. So if you use a single driver speaker, if you're talking about a voice microphone, if you use something that's 208K, that will get almost all of the everything except the proximity effect, it will get you.
Yeah, these guys are like 150 hertz or so nominal response to 16K or something.
You might still for a nice 3-inch.
These are 4-inch speakers.
Yeah, just get a nice close back 3-inch mid range and show the thing right up next to it.
Okay.
It wouldn't give you exact results of what you get with the voice, but what you get with the voice depends so much on the person who's talking into it anyhow. Some different people do this. This gives you more articulation and less bass. This gives you lots of bass. And it's the same thing either way.
But the purpose of this is to see which microphones are outliers.
Different, yeah. And that will work either way. Yeah. As long as you can get nice, consistent positioning.
Right. Okay.
It might be useful to
another shot at it.
It might be useful to point out that what Dan is doing, I assume, is trying to evaluate SM58 microphones, which are good performance microphones. They're not the best microphone for speech reinforcement. If you have someone who's talking, not singing, the 58 is not a good choice if they're going to use it close. You want to use an omnidirectional microphone so that it sounds at least the same as frequency response at all distance, which this one will not.
Except if you're using monitors, then omni is a problem.
It won't make any difference. I'll prove it.
It does in my experience. I hear the room out there.
Oh, you might hear the room. It won't. At this distance, it's not going to change your feedback threshold, though.
Okay. You hold the microphone.
I'll take it.
I can be a mic stand.
Is that your friend Mike?
Mike? Steve? Is there a consensus on what makes a better interface, USB or FireWire? And is an interface also the same thing that you have? Is it the DVA connectors? Without the multi-pins in it?
I think that's borderline of a religious issue.
The short answer is USB is great if you've only got two inputs or so. If you want a bunch of inputs, you might want to go with something that has more bus capacity. Yeah.
Except
there's
USB 3 now.
Yes.
It shouldn't matter. What should matter is who made the gear, how good a job they did making the gear. Back in the dawn of time with only USB 1.0, then FireWire was a lot more bandwidth. And also, FireWire is a little bit more flexible in architecture. You can take multiple FireWire devices and plug them into each other, and you can make that work. USB has a master-slave thing going on where it has to be, you have to have a slave plugged into a master. So like your PC is the master and the audio device would be the slave. So in the early days, it wasn't clear which one would win, and some manufacturers went with one, some went with other. The general trend is that they know USB will be on every computer. So new devices are frequently being made with USB.
FireWire is going away.
FireWire is sort of going away, yeah. You don't need USB 3.0 for audio. Actually, even USB 1.0 is maybe enough for audio, but USB 2.0 is plenty. USB 2.0 really isn't as good as FireWire, but it's good enough. We're not doing video, we're doing audio. Our bit rates are actually not as bad as you might think. So, short answer, I don't think it matters, just buy good gear.
330.
Actually, 2.0 is starting to get phased out too. A lot of the new laptops, you'll get at least 1 to 2, 3.0 USB ports with maybe 2.8.
Yeah, but everything's always backwards compatible. USB 2.0 devices will work with 3.0 port.
So Bob, and
I have a question for you.
What, between the FireWire and the USB, don't the protocols for FireWire actually support streaming data better than, there's less overhead in the exchange of data than there is in USB? So streaming data is a little bit more efficient on FireWire?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. That's why I said that FireWire 400, the 400 is the speed measure, and the equivalent measure for USB 2 is 480, but that is deceptive because the USB protocol has a lot more overhead. You can actually push more data through a FireWire 400 than you can push through USB 2.0. But on the other hand, I don't know what you would need that level of data for audio. For a webcam, you need maybe that level of data, but for audio, Even USB 1.0 is like 12 megabit, and that's actually a lot of audio. So I.
But what if you're trying to put like 32 channels at 2496 through? Then.
There you go. Then you need more bandwidth. And I mean, you can multiply it out, how many bits per sample, how many channels, mm-hmm. and sampling rate, and you multiply it all out, and you'll get a total number of bits per second. And then even that number is not enough because you need to allow for the overhead. So if that number starts to be appreciably close to 480, then you might actually saturate USB 2.0. In fact, I would, you know, given the overhead of USB, I wouldn't even hope to come close to 480. This figure, maybe around 400-ish. But then USB 3.0 is coming out, and I don't know what the difference will be there. Faster, but I don't know exactly how much.
So, Lars, you and I were talking earlier about a question that you had about the integration of subs into a PA. And do you want to ask the group here? Because I was pretty worthless at answering your question.
Well, part of what I was hoping to pull out of today, this has been a lot of theory, a lot of good math. I'm trying to correlate to my practical
day-to-day, as a sound guy goes into a remote location many times a week, and I've got a limited amount of time to set up a sound system and have that interact with its environment, and then also, at the end of the day, provide a pleasing experience for the people that might be attending these events. So, I think, as a sound person, I struggle with, obviously, the low end is always sounding very different from room to room. You can measure speakers, and from a frequency on up, sometimes they will equal what the manufacturer has published.
Sometimes,
exactly. But it's the low end is just a crapshoot. And so, asking Dan if there are any techniques, if there's measurement, I use Smart, and within Smart, I struggle to do any sort of capture the delay times of something under 150 cycles, certainly under 100 cycles. And when I'm trying to delay subs to my mains, or even just track the phase of subs, I'm unable to interpret the data that I get. If I get useful, I'm not even sure I'm getting useful data in Smart.
The problem is that when you try to capture base information, you need to capture those long pressure, so if you're using it on the microphone, you're losing 3/4 of the information. So you're hosed before you start. I have proposed that people make an basically an XYZW microphone. It doesn't have to be something super like a counteract, but something made out of, you know, a couple cheap electrets. What I would do is probably make something that looked like a B format, but just merged to it came into B, looked like a B format of low frequencies to use for room measurement. Because then you can measure the energy storage in the room. And that energy storage in the room is what's killing you, because if you walk around and it sounds different here, it sounds different there. If you can figure out what the modes are, where they are, chances are it should be possible to design, a little graphic interface that will say, try putting the woofer here. Now, it may tell you to put it under the president's seat. I mean, I understand the limits, but it could lead, at least you can figure out where the energy is being stored in the room. And you can't do that with it. You can't do that with a pressure microphone. You can do it maybe with 10 or 12 of them strewn all over the room.
By walking around?
Well, the catch is...
You can get nodes and stuff.
Yeah, but the point is if you walk around and the microphone and the measurement knows where you are, that requires not just walking around, but also knowing where you are when you make the measurements. I realize it's not a useful answer, but... That's one of the reasons you don't get any results is because you don't have the information in the first place.
Along with that, I'm sure the people that are doing live sound also experience with these measurement tools. They're wonderful, but they're giving you information based on small space in this vast room. So you're measuring, you're making analysis of a single point in that space, which may or may not average to what the room sounds like.
Yep. And that's where these multiple microphones are useful, to measure, sample multiple spaces. but it takes forever. And I don't get it.
Well, that's part of the problem is to get to do it right. It's not half an hour. That's exactly the problem. And if you've got half an hour to set up, you've been lucky. So I don't have, there's not a good practical answer, I don't think, unless you can do something like, that's a concept. A microphone with an accelerometer so it knows where you walk around. You know, it doesn't have to be super active.
Yes.
Well, not in a building? No. In a building is a problem. Yeah, but something they can just figure out more or less how far you move from point to point, you know, might do something. It's easy. You look like you're thinking.
If there is a pressure velocity combination microphone, it's just for instrumentation.
Well, is it a variety?
And you can overlay it with a photograph of this space moving around, and it'll draw acoustic intensity. It'll draw an acoustic intensity map. Very expensive. It's like a $10,000 instrument. But it will do what you say at a given frequency.
Yeah. The problem is if you like to be able to do all this in 10 minutes, you have
can't
to
do it.
After you hook the stuff up. That's what kills you. This is when it comes back to you listen and you fake it. Yeah, I'm sorry, but.
That's what I do with my ears.
Oh, yeah.
I walk the spaces, you know, and listen to everywhere and try to mentally average it. That's whatever.
One of the things you can probably use that for is if you see lots of strong single lines in the pulse response, you know, if you see lots of specular reflections, you know that you're going to have to walk around the room. If it gets nice and diffused, you're probably going to be okay. Or if you see lots of specular reflections, you know the room is going to change character a lot and move around. It doesn't tell you what to do, but it tells you when it's really going to suck.
Any other problems like Lars's?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we get to the part that could easily take us 2 weeks to talk about in depth, and we finish it. So, I'm not sure what that says.
What are some, we just talked about one little part of SMART, and I assume the SIM as well. What are some of, I know, because I've used it for doing some other stuff. The earlier versions of SMART, it's been one of the things I've played with it, so I'm not quite sure. What else, besides what we're doing right here, do you use SMART? Do you use SMART for anything else besides doing this?
Actually SMART 5, I wish they would put back a feature called SPL time history. And you actually could do either fast or slow, your eighth or 1 second integration times, or averaging times, and your instantaneous, you actually got as close as they could get with their system sampling it. You get a time history graph. So as time went by, if I gave a tarantula like this, you'd see a sudden pop up and then back down again in a time history. And then you could also have a spectrogram going at the same time down below. So for someone like me who's in the medical device business, trying to pick out an alert tone, beep, 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 has a particular spectral quality and happens in a certain pattern, and it's having to be measured in an environment that's hostile to making measurements. This particular SPL time history and the spectrum allowed me from the spectrum to identify the particular thing that I'm looking at, and in the graph that's right above it, that's running along with it, if the peaks exceeded the background noise, I could actually get a pretty accurate SPL for those tones. That's an example of a very specific thing that I could do in SMART 5 that I can't do in SMART 7 now. They took away the SPL time history, and they also rotated the spectrogram so it runs from bottom to top instead of from side to side. So you'd never get two graphs going this way. The reasoning being that they wanted the spectrum to match up with the spectrogram to match up with this frequency chart here. The x-axis would be the same on both. But I've been begging them to put that feature back. SPL time history, I find, as being an interesting thing. Another thing we didn't even talk about in here is the logging of loudness equivalents. And, you know, the L50, L90, L10, all of those things, A-weighted, C-weighted. I don't know if they let you do all of them simultaneously in 7, but in 5 you could. You could set up your log and say, okay, I want to do a survey of the site for the sound levels, and turn it on and walk away once you had everything set up, and come back and collect up your data over the period of time that you were interested in.
Can't you keep both versions?
Huh?
Can't you have both versions on it?
I actually, on my other laptop, I have version 5. I've kept it.
You can't use both on the same?
I haven't tried using both on the same. I don't know if that would work or not. I just have 2 separate units.
Doesn't SMARTS, for the display up there, you can set it to monitor your LEQ60?
Yeah, you can. There's a whole bunch of things you can set up for.
So in a concert, we have a limit of 95 dBA SPL at 50 feet mm-hmm. per a minute. So you can set, and you can have a running.
Sure.
You can have a running minute.
There it is, your LEQ minutes and what weighting you'd like to use, and your sampling intervals and the file that you're going to run it in. But often what you do over here, there's a little, here's the number that we're currently running at, and here's a max right there. Let me reset the max. It's 64, 65. Whoops, I got a 90.8 dB max impulse, but that doesn't tell you what period of time it was over, the integration. Smart tools, though, in... For all of you that are iPad users, there is a Studio 6 Digital has an audio tools system, of which they make, they've licensed the single channel code for Smart here. In other words, this display right here, if I turn it on. So there we go. This particular stuff shows up in their audio tools. I think it's about $60 for the smart tools, and then they have a traffic light in there, three SPL meters, and one of them you can set. One looks like your Radio Shack, one looks like a more modern digital, and then they have the traffic light. You set the integration times on the traffic light, and it's got green, yellow, and red. And when the microphone, the sound level at the microphone exceeds the threshold you've set for the period of time you set, the red light will come on. And the iPad can be much more accurate than its native microphone by getting the camera kit USB interface, and then go get yourself something like a Sound Devices Mix Pre-D. I actually have that one. Plug it in. Works like a champ. Your iPad now becomes a very accurate tool, and you put whatever measurement microphone you want on the outside, calibrate it like we discussed earlier in the day, and you've got a very accurate system with that feature that you're talking about. And it's big enough on the display that you can see it all around the room, not a small room. You deal with really big rooms.
And bright in the summer.
That's right. Any other questions? Are we at a wrap?
What is the recipe of Clayton's
father? African or European?
Why does the Porridgeburg lay his egg in the air? Is that the question?
2 different groups.
Okay.
Monty Python and Fireside Theater.
Well, thank you. Thanks for being attentive.
So